Let me simply pose some of the problems that arise. Kids, I have five. We also live in a total, this wasn't true for the Canadians from Winnipeg, they were a little amazed to hear that we had even a more serious problem in this area than they do in Canada. All civilized societies basically at least finance their education system, so it's a public education system, but of course we don't do that here in the United States. And one inevitably poses the dilemma of, you want to do the best for your kids. You want them to have the opportunities that they can make good use of. And the way we finance higher education in the United States, that can become a very expensive proposition. Now, if we live in egalitarian, sort of sustainable communities, if we figure out some way so that we can essentially receive reward for economic needs in accordance with the work or the effort we do, and we work out some way of arranging that with a broader group of people than our own little nuclear family, how are we going to deal with that issue? How do we deal with the fact that people from within our community are going to have legitimate needs to resources outside our community that somehow will have to make decisions about how they're provided, if they are provided, on what sort of basis, etc. What do we do about the fact that what we believe, how we think people should be rewarded for work, is not how the outside economy rewards people for work? How do we deal with the question, how are we going to deal with the problem when it arises, which it will inevitably arise, and it'll arise over and over and over again, that somebody from within our movement can go out and get a job in a dot-com. My eldest son just did that this year. He was in graduate school, wasn't happy with his program, dropped out, had himself a nice math degree, and a dot-com came along and offered to pay him a ridiculous salary, way beyond anything he did. Way beyond anything he had any right to sort of deserve or want. Which he knows. He said, well, I guess I'm going to do this because I do have $40,000 worth of student loans and I can pay it off in 1 year. So what do I say to him? I said, go for it! Another major dilemma that we will face as we try to live the kind of lives we believe in and we wish all to be able to choose to live if they should so choose and want, is how to go about that in a way that doesn't isolate ourselves from the people that we need to reach out to. That's a very difficult thing. I didn't think I was making a speech, and I didn't come with handouts, and I certainly don't have enough for everybody. But there's about 30 copies of a one-page thing here, and one of the things that's listed on there, one of the ideas was, I was going to say, well, there are some resources that you can go look at. There are people who have been trying to organize and live in what one group calls egalitarian sustainable communities. Some of these communities go back 25, 30 years. There also are some environmentally oriented sustainable communities. There's a whole network of them up in the northeastern part of the United States. And you can go to various places on the internet and sort of find out about these people. But how in general do those of us who do that kind of thing, who go ahead and become parts of communities like that, whether it's an environmental community, one of the interesting new developments in this sustainable egalitarian community network of sort of groups is that the early ones basically became farming type activities. And in that particular network, in the past 5 or 6 years, urban groups, the one that I met and talked with was one called Beacon Hill House that's out in the Seattle area. These are urban groups where people get together, they pool resources in some sense or another. Some of them have sort of straight jobs with decent incomes. Others are working full-time for movement organizations that either don't pay or pay very little. Of course, we want to be able to work We don't want to always have to go in order to make a living, sustain a family, contribute to kids that we feel responsible for. We don't want to be in the position where we're always tempted by that sort of mainstream enviro group that would actually pay you. No, we want to be able to work for the organizations we believe in. Well, one way to do that is you've got people living together and there's some outside jobs that are basically funding, paying salaries or paying wages and living expenses for people who are doing other things. I know lots of you do this. I know that's the way that movement activists work and have always worked. But it's important to work. It's important to improve how well we do that, and to improve it with an eye to how it can become long-term and how it can become sustaining, and at the same time not isolating. So this Beacon Hill House, for instance, and some of the newer groups that have become part of this egalitarian, sustainable living communities network, are basically in cities. Sometimes they rent a building, sometimes they go ahead and buy a building. It's people working in urban jobs, and then basically what they view, to some extent, they figure out ways where that money and any time that people have is something they discuss about, well, are we going to, they were talking about what contributions to make, financial contributions they were going to be making to various groups and political activities in the Seattle area. And then what contributions that their group makes in terms of time, in terms of the amount of time that they have people who are putting into to activities. Really, what I have to say on this subject is I'm convinced it's a far more important issue than most people in the movement have ever believed it is. When we discuss this, when the movement discusses this, it usually gets discussed as burnout, which is sort of a real badass way of coming at it. Burnout is the consequence of having failed to succeed in helping people live the way we believe and we preach is possible. We don't need solutions. We don't need to find a solution to burnout after burnout has taken place. Instead, we need to be more constantly thinking about how it is that we nurture and care for ourselves and others in ways that are consistent with our values, that are fair, that are democratic, and that are not confined to a subculture or a part of the age distribution, and that do not tend to isolate us and make it more difficult for people. We want something that people of all ages and all racial communities and cultural backgrounds can look at and say, those people are out there practicing what they preach. And they say, what they preach sounds pretty damn good. But I want to know whether it looks like, I want to know whether it looks like they're enjoying themselves. Whether it really is a better way of life. Because that's what they claim. And that's what I want to know before I join up. And before I get involved. And I just think that that's a problem that gets far too little attention. We too seldom discuss the serious obstacles and problems that have to be overcome. And I know, as a participant in the anti-globalization movement, that we're in it for the long haul. This isn't going to go away. We can't gear ourselves up to go engage in nonviolent civil disobedience twice a year for 5 or 6 years and think that's going to do it, because it's not. So in any case, I knew I wasn't going to come with solutions. Even if I'd been told, you're going to give a talk to a group this big, I wasn't going to come up with solutions. And I would like to try and run this at this point as a workshop and have people speak to this question and voice concerns or ideas or put issues or questions to others too. Yeah.
I'll pose a question to you and then ask if anyone else wants to comment also. I read a little bit about participatory economics, but can you give me some of the specific details of what you're talking about?
Oh, sure.
When you're talking about egalitarian division of labor and that sort of thing.
Okay. 5-minute thumbnail. What are the essential features of participatory economics? I think of it simply as the economics of equitable cooperation. That we're human beings. We believe that human beings can cooperate with one another in ways that are mutually fulfilling, and that we can behave equitably or fairly regarding one another, and that we can organize this in a democratic fashion. We think that that's what human life is all about, and that's what economic life should all be about. Of course, capitalism has distorted that beyond recognition. I think that centrally planned totalitarian Soviet-style societies distorted that beyond recognition as well. Now, what are some of the specific features? One is, our suggestion is that work should be organized into workers' councils. That's who should make decisions about what goes on in workplace. We also think that consumption should be organized into neighborhood consumption councils. We think that these work councils and consumption councils should basically belong to federations, and that these councils and these federations are the groups that actually go about constructing the plan for how the economy will work in a way that really is a kind of democratic cooperation, rather than some group of planners somehow being handed goals and asked to come up with a plan. So we have workers' councils, consumer councils. We have a way of replacing competitive markets and central planning that means that we call participatory planning. It's the actual workers' councils and consumer councils and their federations that are doing the planning. Every group is in the position in this economy. Every workers' council proposes its own work activities and revises its own work activities when they get back information from the planning process about what it is they've proposed implies for others. We also propose that in these workers' councils that there be two important features beyond one person, one vote. One is that reward or remuneration basically be according to what we call effort or sacrifice, rather than some attempt to measure the value of the contribution of different people in a workplace. Market systems basically reward labor when there isn't discrimination, when there isn't monopoly, when there isn't all the horrific real-world aspects. But the essential reward system in a market economy regarding labor is according to the value that labor has for the person who hires it. And we think that is fundamentally always going to be unfair, and that a whole different principle is the one that should guide reward. That instead of rewarding according to the value of contribution, where some people will inevitably always be in a position where the value of their contribution, through no particular sort of merit of their own, will be higher than the value of the contribution of somebody else. But that instead the principle should be reward according to how much sacrifice did you make? If I sacrificed more, if I worked longer hours, if I worked in a task or an arrangement that was somehow more dangerous, well, then there might, then and only then do we argue is there a reason that somebody might actually deserve more compensation. So our suggestion is that, and now the question is, well, how would you implement that? If that's, suppose you agree that people should basically be paid according to the work and effort they put in and the sacrifices they make, rather than the value of the contribution they make in the economy. How are you going to actually implement that? And our suggestion is, well, it's imperfect, but there's no better way than basically having your workmates in your workers' council be the ones who decide. Each workers' council will go about it differently, but basically your workmates are going to have to decide whether or not you are working as hard as they are, etc. then people go with that to their neighborhood consumption councils in our economy and our proposal, and that's what basically determines how much you have a right to ask for as a consumer. How it is that all this is organized with families and kids, etc., we've sort of not written about that, because there's lots of different ways to do it. There's lots of people that are going to have presumably very, very good ideas about the pros and cons of that. I'm not saying they aren't important, critical issues. But you could work out that in a lot of different ways, consistent with this sort of overall framework that we call the participatory economy. The other feature that we've proposed that's far and away the most controversial, actually it's reward according to effort or sacrifice, is of course highly controversial within the economics profession, and frankly highly controversial amongst those people who call themselves political economists or radical political economists, and who are my fellow members of the Union of Radical Political Economists, etc. The majority of political economists in the United States are probably adherents to one form or another of market socialism at this point. I'd say it's about three quarters, one quarter. One quarter, democratic planning of some sort. Three quarters, no. That planning stuff was all terrible. And we basically need to understand that the market is with us and it's not such a bad thing. So, in any case, rewarding, but the problem with, one of the problems with market socialism, you can't reward according to effort or sacrifice. You're going to inevitably end up rewarding according to value of contribution. The other feature that's controversial is what we call balancing job complexes. We can't see that in an equitable, fair economy, there's any reason for why it is that some people's jobs should be ones that the tasks they carry out empower them and give them more information, more of the kinds of skills that will allow them to influence outcomes about what it is that's decided. We think a serious effort has to be made so that all who work in a workplace engage in some tasks that lead them, help them become active participants in decision making about what goes on in that workplace. The way I usually explain it is, look, if you have somebody sweeping floors for 30 years, for 40 hours a week, and you have other people who are constantly going to this meeting and that meeting about whether this new product or this new technology is a good or a bad idea, you can give them both one person, one vote. You can send them both to the Workers' Council meeting and say you've got economic democracy. But what you have is formally equal rights to participate, not effectively equal rights to participate. And if we believe that people should be given the tools to participate in fashioning their own lives, which I do. I think that's what it means to be human and to recognize that all humans are capable of living as humans. Then we have to seriously think about ways to reorganize how it is that tasks are grouped into jobs so that you roughly balance people's work lives for empowerment. And we've argued also that it should be balanced for desirability. There are nasty tasks, then there are pleasant tasks. I usually give the example of being a professor. It's a very unbalanced job complex compared to the average in the economy. I mostly don't have a boss. I mostly do what I want. I get a pretty good paycheck. A colleague of mine who was by no means a radical sat at a faculty meeting when all faculty always sit around and grouse sooner or later. So we're sitting around and grousing about how our offices are old and our computers aren't very good and the university computer service is more of a liability than a help and that our pay is less than across the street at some other university. And finally, this particular faculty member just said, "Damn, that's right, but it sure as hell beats a real job." So the issue here is whether or not there's anything equitable or fair about some people's work lives being dramatically more desirable than other people's work lives. And if the answer is no, which we think it is, then you have to design an economy that will somehow do something about that. So balancing job complexes for empowerment and desirability, setting up a democratic system to attempt to reward according to sacrifice rather than the value of contribution, where people through no fault of their own will have dramatically different abilities to make more or less valuable contributions. And replacing either totalitarian planning from a planning elite or market competition, which will inevitably sort of funnel back in the direction of the kind of competitive capitalism that we're battling against. Replacing that with some system of democratic planning where you focus people, the planning that people are most responsible for is the stuff that they are the ones who are going to carry out. And yet, it's simply true that what people do in one factory has some effect on what people can or will have to do in other factories, so it's not like it should be entirely up to the people in one factory exactly. That has to be somehow worked out and coordinated, and that means you have to have some people who have some training as an economist thinking about these things and trying to work out ways to do that. Anyway, I took longer than the 5 minutes, but that is, in a nutshell, the kind of economy we've proposed is something that is far superior to capitalism, perfectly within human beings' capabilities of carrying out, but that doesn't mean it's going to be easy to convince others to basically take the economy over from the people who want it to run as a capitalist economy, because they are being privileged and benefited by that system. And at this point in time, I think it's also something that's going to take some time before we convince ourselves that these kinds of things can really be done. And that's why I do believe that if that's what you think, if you believe in that kind of economic vision, then it seems to me you have to believe in the importance of beginning to do that as best we can within our movement to both learn and practice and show others. Yes?
I'm from Oregon, and there's quite a few cooperative businesses that are attempting to do exactly what it is that you're talking about, but they simply get out of coordinate. They can't exist in the marketplace, and so that kind of goes into the implementation process. How do you see, bridging that, going from, okay, we have the groundwork, we know how to operate with each other, how do you take that to the next step?
My pet project for the moment, the thing that I try and put as much time and energy into as I can, is something called the Institute for Economic Democracy. It's a little on the academic side compared to movement activity. It's an attempt to build an institute using the internet that doesn't have the usual funding problems and necessities and therefore reliance on traditional funders. But more than that, it's an attempt to gather into one place where people can at least find out from other people all sorts of projects that are trying to do, that are trying to either think through clearly or practice some form of economic democracy. So there's like 20 working groups in this institute. One of the working groups is a working group that either of people who either study as academics or who work in and organize workers' cooperatives. The plywood industry out in the Northwest is an industry with a long tradition. And it's a sad ending, where there was a time when there were cooperative plywood factories out there that were roughly on a par with capitalist plywood factories. And it is true that over a period of 20 or 30 years, two things happened. One was the cooperatives tended to be out-competed by the capitalist firms, and the question is, why? And the answer isn't simple. And it's not necessarily that they were less efficient. Being less commercially viable is not the same as being less efficient. But being less commercially viable is the same as getting competed out of business. So there's a working group that looks at cooperatives like that. Some of the people in that group study those situations. Some of the people in that group work in those cooperatives or manage or are on boards in those cooperatives. There's fishing co-ops up in Halifax, and there's a group of people in that group that are from that sort of background. There's also a working group that is mostly made up of people in food co-ops. And there is another place where there's a lot of discussion about, we have our ideas, we want to do things in a certain way. A, we don't want to be competed out of business. We want to remain... all the food co-ops will tell you two things. We want to remain commercially viable. And when they have discussion groups amongst themselves, that's at least half of what the conversation is about. And the other thing they'll say is, but we don't want to be just like those capitalist, you know, food businesses that we don't want to be competed out of business by. We have goals as far as what kinds of products we do or don't provide, why we do or don't, goals about how we organize ourselves and how we make decisions, goals about how we pay people. We have our own internal goals about how we want to be different. Well, how do we keep those things from being eroded away in our attempt to not get competed out of business in basically the rat race? And then the critical question becomes, is there some way that we can work with one another? Is there some way that we can begin to do some sort of planning amongst ourselves in a way that is not simply market competition, but that allows us to preserve our internal values and even strengthens us as a group in terms of our overall commercial viability as a network of food cooperatives rather than individual food cooperatives that have to exist and compete as individual cooperatives in the capitalist marketplace. There's no magical answers. There's a lot of things to learn about what works and what doesn't work and what the inevitable consequences of certain choices are. And one of the purposes of this institute is to give people who are concerned with those things, you know, a place that they can go and talk about that with one another. But I think it's I think it would be a terrible mistake to conclude that the fact that many attempts at cooperative types of enterprises have been competed out of business, that that means that they are inefficient or that they are somehow inferior. There's all sorts of other reasons for why that happens. And I think an equally serious problem is how to keep competition in the market during the time period when you have no choice but to basically do that, how to keep that from sort of slowly picking away and eroding away at the reasons that you tried to do something different in the first place. I think that's an equally dangerous outcome that has to be carefully thought about in order to be avoided.
Do you have a website for that?
Yeah, it's www.svied.org. Of course, anybody who's interested in more material than you'd ever want to read about participatory economics should go to the ZNet website, where you just go to ZNet and you find the Pair Econ project and you click on it and then you're inundated. Yes?
The vision that goes along with this project with the small communities, usually cooperative, non-sovereign, self-sustainable as much as possible on a global scale, where access would be which would have more than material ownership. How could you tie that idea of access as opposed to ownership into your
it sounds to me like what you're describing and our sort of vision or recommendation are very much the same, if not exactly the same, using slightly different words. In a participatory economy, as a consumer, if you ask for shoes and shirts and CDs and CD players, and when you get them, they're yours. But people don't own productive property in a participatory economy. As a matter of fact, what happens is, what's really happening in the planning system is, groups of workers are saying, look, this is what we want to do. To do this, we need the following things. So what's happening is, basically, workers are, in some sense, bidding or negotiating with one another user rights over productive resources. And as long as you demonstrate in the planning process that you're going to make good use of these productive resources, the procedures are designed to basically make sure that people who are going to make good use of resources basically are then allocated the user rights over those things. But it is a user right as long as you're using it usefully. It's not you own it, you hope it appreciates in value so that you can make a capital gain if you sell it. That's not the way that any of that is owned, or and that's not the mentality about it in the kind of economy that we've suggested and tried to work out the details of how it could be possible.
Do you include an idea of vision?
We always get in trouble on this. Let me give the simple answer. The simple answer is we weren't trying to do something that elaborate. We basically were simply trying to answer the question, could you please describe a sensible way that the economy could be run? So we think of this as a desirable way of organizing the economy. Somebody's got to figure out a desirable way to organize political life and the political system. Somebody has to figure out a desirable way to organize international relations and whether the nation state or sovereignty plays some role or does not play some role or what role it does. We don't pretend to have done that. Actually, I mean, one of the other things that we frequently get, you know, criticized for is, well, you haven't really addressed many of the important issues that women are concerned with about childcare and who does it and how it's shared, how households work, etc. You're right. We haven't. And maybe neither of us, maybe Mike Albert and I aren't the best people to do that. What our hope is, what we believe is, we've designed an economy that's consistent with the values, democratic, egalitarian, sustainable values. And that means that it needs, that kind of economy will only work in the context where the political system and gender relations basically are also respective of and expressive of those values. What it is that the details of how that should be done, we don't claim to be experts on. We don't claim that our proposal answers those questions. So, I mean, that's, and I'm gathering from what you're saying that the issue of sovereignty and sort of nation-state status in the sort of system of economic cooperation. For us, that's sort of a basic thing that has to be decided in the political sphere. And we've read things about it. We like some ideas better than others, but it's outside of the realm. It's outside of the realm in which we...
I don't want to take any more time, but I just don't understand the definition of, or maybe the definition of economy.
Some system for taking care of the production and consumption of the material means of life that serves rather than subverts the values of democracy, fairness, and environmental sustainability.
How do you address the question of need? If in one of these communities there's someone who, you know, has a terminal illness that's going to cost them millions of dollars to take care of?
I was speaking briefly. We have never proposed that people's economic... that people receive economic goods and services, including healthcare, for instance, solely on the basis of effort or sacrifice. As a matter of fact, we point out one of the obvious problems with that is, what if you've got two people who sort of made equal sacrifices and somebody, and one of those two people becomes a victim of AIDS through no fault of their own, and, you know, 5-6 years ago I checked with a doctor friend and said, what does it cost society? Not what do people actually pay. What does it cost society to give a humane medical treatment program to a terminal AIDS patient? And the doctor said, well, that's an interesting question. It's about $1 million. Most people don't know that. That's part of the reason the county hospital systems in the big cities are all bankrupt. So we've never proposed that in a real version of this economy, that remuneration be on the basis of effort alone. As a matter of fact, our proposal is that the neighborhood consumption councils are the place where you take your effort rating, but that's where there's a decision about what it is that you actually achieve, what it is you achieve, and that's the place where allocation on the basis of need can take place. And that's completely aside of whether you have a totally free medical system, which of course we believe you should, and a totally free educational system, which of course we believe you should. So we're not going to leave those kinds of things. But it still is the case that some people have greater need. And just as in a family, when you sit down at the table, you don't put out, you don't give the 14-year-old teenager and the 6-year-old the same portion of food. That's the kind of thing that we're proposing that should basically take place in the economy as well. So what we've really proposed is, as an alternative to the market value of your services, that's what you get paid. No, it should be according to your sacrifice, to your effort. But there is then a need issue that is above and beyond that, that we are suggesting, of course, should be treated, you know, seriously, and there have to be procedures for doing that. Yes?
To what extent does your theory of balancing the job complex mean that there's going to be a rotation of tasks within the division of labor?
A lot of people have argued, well, this balanced job complex idea is going to be incredibly inefficient because it's going to ruin the efficiency gains from specialization. And it's also the balancing for empowerment people have criticized on the grounds that it eliminates the legitimate role of expertise. Important questions. I think expertise has a legitimate role. But the legitimate role for expertise, some people on some issues, because of training, background, and experience, will have more informed opinions. You want to set up procedures where those more informed opinions are voiced and become known to or heard by all. But just because I have more expertise on an issue doesn't give me the right to have more decision-making power on that if you are just as affected by the outcome of that decision as I am. Experts shouldn't be making decisions for the rest of us who are just as affected or more affected by their decision than they are. Experts should be communicating to us the information we have, and then decision-making should be according to the degree to which you're affected, which is our proposal. Our basic argument is no, we don't think that balancing for empowerment eliminates the legitimate role of expertise that should play. And we also don't, we're not proposing a system where there's no continuity to the tasks that you carry out. There might be a certain amount of rotation, but we're not talking about, the issue here is if you have a skilled task, do you then also sometimes do an unskilled task as part of what you do? And our answer to that is yes. But that doesn't mean that somehow you rotate, people are rotating amongst a dozen different skilled tasks, which of course they couldn't have training for. Nobody would want to take the time to train people. I mean, this is something that people have asked, it's been debated. This is a very active part of the debate between people who believe in some sort of system of democratic planning and some dramatic change in the structuring of work life. A lot of market socialists don't think that the structure of work life is that badly structured at this point. And then there's some of us who think, no, it's very, very badly structured and inevitably disruptive and destructive of the goals that we and market socialists usually claim that they believe in. So one very, very active debate is whether or not there are some disadvantages to these balanced job complexes, and we've written about why we think that is not the case in the main and how it could be avoided in particular, you know, through particular procedures. One of the reasons that capitalism is so destructive to the environment is that in a lot of different ways, it orients people towards satisfying human needs through greater material accumulation. Now, it's important to design an economy that doesn't do that, that essentially doesn't put people in a situation where there are all sorts of pressures on individuals that lead in that direction. A participatory economy is not an accumulation economy. It's a system in which you basically don't get much for accumulating beyond what it is that you actually have use for. And in that sense, hopefully, it's not an economy where decisions are driven by sort of competitive dictates, and where if you don't accumulate or if you don't have a higher rate of profit rate than somebody else, then somebody in the financial markets is going to come in and arrange for a takeover, a hostile takeover, and you're the one that's out of business. It's not a system that works that way. So we basically hope to have eliminated the competitive dynamic in a private enterprise market economy that is in part responsible for this drive. I think we've also tried to create a system in which people, ordinary people, would not find it a sensible strategy to try and seek social recognition through the accumulation of material belongings. Not that it would, it'd be pretty much impossible to do that anyway under the rules of the game, and there'd also be very little incentive for people to attempt, you know, to satisfy their needs for respect on the part of others by getting a bigger pile of goodies to somehow demonstrate their worth through. So in that sense, we claim that's one of the ways in which we think this economy is capable of coexisting with the environment rather than destroying it.
So sort of rethink the whole problem by eliminating that idea of unlimited wants.
I'm not sure that the wants that people have will not always be such that the resources available for fulfilling them are scarce. We would rather have more because we could fulfill more of our wants if we did. In terms of people who work with the environment, the other major difference between a participatory economy and a market system is it's very, very carefully designed so that damages to the environment are counted in the decision-making process about what it is that something is, what are the actual benefits of having certain things made in certain ways as opposed to what are the actual costs. One of the problems with market systems is that they leave a host of externalities, basically pollution, out of the accounting system. And then we have to come in sort of like the doctor after the disease is hit and try and fix up the mess that's being created every day when the decisions are made in the first place. So the idea here is to have a proper accounting, have a procedure that allows for a proper accounting of environmental costs and benefits from different choices that are made, and have that stuff count in the day-to-day decision-making about how we do use these resources to satisfy the needs we have. So that's the other feature that hopefully is far more friendly as far as the environment is concerned. Yes?
How would you define use, and how would you account for things that are more creative things or art things that are enriching people's lives, like music or books? How would you account for those kinds of things?
This is not my favorite question. It's Michael Albert's favorite question. He loves this question because he says then he gets to say, we count it just like we count anything else because it isn't any different. She's saying, well, how does your system take care of things like art or music? People who create, that's what they produce. They produce art or they produce music. How does your system take account of that? I actually think I think there are some extra complications. Mike loves to say there aren't any, all the issues are exactly the same. And there does have to be a dividing line. You have to decide what's work and what's pleasure. Some people will go out and create music or create art because that's what they're doing in their spare time. That's their pleasure. And they're not asking that be considered as their contribution, their effort, their sacrifice, that then they are being rewarded in according with, you know, by the economy. But then, of course, we are going to have people who work as artists. The whole Napster situation is very, very interesting. There's a dilemma here. If we all get our music for free, what happens to the record? What happens to the pay for the creators of this music that we like? When you pose it that way, Mike assures me, because he argues with people about this all the time, he says, oh, well, that's true. I mean, there has to be some way to get these groups paid for. Now, one answer is, well, they go on tour anyway. You know, so isn't that plenty? And it probably is under the circumstances. Our idea would be run the economy in a way where you have people who create music and who create art, and they are compensated for that effort and energy that they exercise just like anybody who works anyplace else. But they're not compensated on the basis of royalties. They don't receive a comp. If you have a hit record, it doesn't mean that somehow you've made your fortune in life as compared to somebody who is creating music and who never has that hit record. You're basically compensating these people just as you're compensating everybody else in the economy for their time and energy put in to functions that are socially or economically useful to other human beings. Yes?
I worked at a food co-op that's very similar to the model that you're talking about. But I think that this, all the stuff that we're talking about, and this is an issue that I think about a lot, this is a revolution. And the way that it's, presented, it's an extreme revolution. More than democracy, I would say, was at the time. But isn't it can it be a gradual revolution? It doesn't have to be a group of people deciding that they want to set up, an autonomous group of that's collectively structured. We don't have to have all of these elements at once. We can have like a simple policy that a company has that is similar to participatory economics. That is an element of participatory economics that can then serve to create a climate of an alternative. So the co-op that I work at is in the middle of a food co-op in the middle of campus at the University of Maryland. And so we are in an economic situation where we can afford to be in such an extreme situation where all the workers are all equal, there's absolutely no division of labor, there's no division of pay, and almost all decisions are made completely democratically at meetings and stuff like that. But there are also collectives around the area that have to compete with, have competition, various other issues that they're dealing with. So they can't afford necessarily, they are efficient, but they can't afford for whatever reason to take in all of those elements. But by existing, by having some elements of pure capitalism, some elements of participatory economics, I think that they are creating an example that then other people can build on eventually.
I completely agree with you. I don't know, in terms of gradualism versus revolution, I would say, first of all, that a participatory economy is an economic revolution. No matter how long a time it took to actually come about, or even if it comes about in a small place, it's a revolution because it's a totally different way of sort of making economic decisions. In that sense, I agree. I think it's a revolution. But in terms of, is there going to be some sort of, you can't do anything until the whole system gets changed, and that gets changed in a very abrupt thing that's called a social revolution. I'm sure in one sense that will not happen. I'm sure that we are 30, 40, 50 years away of practicing this stuff well enough to actually know, to convince ourselves, and we have to, if we believe in democracy, 2/3 of the people have to believe they want something like this. I basically have the 1/3, 1/3, 1/3 rule. This is how democracy works in the imperfect world of real life. 1/3 of the population would have to be, they would have to somehow really believe in this stuff and have done some of it or committed to it. They'd have to consider themselves part of a movement that wants an economy like this, not an economy like capitalism. Another 1/3 has to basically be the middle 1/3 that sort of isn't that involved and they've got their own problems and they don't think about, but they've got to basically side with us. They got to vote with us. They got to side with us against the bastards. And if we have 2/3 like that, then we start passing laws. Then we start making the little system that we have sort of worked in the nooks and crannies for decades and decades. Then we say, hey, 2/3 of the people want a different kind of economy. We've got a perfectly legitimate democratic right to go about setting it up and starting to pass the rules that make the conditions such that everybody is facing the conditions that you do at Maryland rather than having to constantly make these concessions to the competitive market dynamics. I'm sure that we are decades away from getting rid of capitalism. And that means we already have to think about a gradual process. And I think that in the movement, making this stuff work for ourselves over the long haul is part of what has to go on during those decades. And when we get two-thirds, when there's one-third of us, and where the other third is thoroughly convinced by us that we're the good guys and they're the bad guys, and we get that kind of an electoral majority, then what will happen when we start to establish what we have every democratic right to is basically going to depend on the bad guys. I don't know. Sometimes we don't get to make the choice about whether or not something is gradual or peaceful. Somebody else makes that choice. But that's a long way down the road, and it really has, in my mind, very little to do with what we have to do in the present. Yes?
Would it be possible or even more feasible to get kind of like a de-evolution back to maybe, say, like more like an agricultural society where bartering and trading is more, would be a better alternative than, say, using money in this type of society? I mean, because money, I mean, in my eyes, has always been, probably always will be, the root of all evil. I don't believe in it. It's, I don't know. So, I mean, wouldn't it be better to have, like, a co-op basically say, okay, look, we're raising these type of crops. You're raising those type of crops. Let's trade and get this all working together and to actually make it flow more. And, like, to basically go back to more of an agricultural society than an industrial society that we live in today.
One of the things we did in the class that we had last fall was we looked at LET systems. My fear with many LET systems is that in fact they think they've done something different than markets and capitalism, and they really haven't. Now, the other thing you mentioned, which is you've got different agricultural co-ops, but they don't all grow the same food, then how should they manage to sort of coordinate their economic activities? Through some form of equitable cooperation planning rather than market exchange. That would be my answer. That you do not want to... If we could go back to that society and then we had market exchange between these groups, well, that's exactly how we ended up where we are right now. This is the outcome of that kind of thing. The barter is just another kind of market exchange. There's a difference between barter and equitable cooperation. We've got to just stay clear about that, clear as a bell, and remember that what we want is equitable cooperation, and we build toward it in every little conceivable place and way we can, and there'll be concessions we have to make, there'll be things that we'll have to do things where we can't do them that way, but we've got to remember the difference between when we're doing the things the way we want to and when we're making concessions to the fact that we just aren't in a situation where we always can do that.
I was wondering, it seems to me that one of the primary premises of capitalism and what it's probably good at is in a situation where there's growth. And, you know, we're fast coming to a place where there's no more room for growth in terms of resources. And so I was wondering if you felt that some sort of change will be forced on capitalism because of that, and I was wondering if you thought that somehow, and the change in psychology that will be necessary because of, you know, the understanding that we cannot grow, can somehow fit with precipitatory economics, yeah, if it's more suited for that sort of stasis rather than growth.
Okay, participatory economy is fine with no growth. The system works great. It's not that the system somehow ends up having problems if there's not growth. You know, it depends on what you mean by growth. I mean, people say, well, we obviously can't have infinite growth. Well, see, that's actually not true. Growth of what? We can't have infinite growth in material objects, but of course we could have infinite growth in the quality of objects. There's nothing that prevents that. I lived at the end of a generation of anti-capitalist activists whose sustained motivation through hard political times with a conviction that came from Marxism that said, we might lose this battle, but eventually victory is ours because capitalism digs its own grave. It is a system that is inherently flawed and is going to undermine itself in the end. I am dead convinced that that was an error. that there is, that is not, I mean, it might be a comforting thought when you just got, you know, when you just got the Jeezy's kicked out of you at the last seven demonstrations. Oh, well, we just lost seven times in a row, but in the end, we're going to win because capitalism can't go on indefinitely. There's a version of that that seems to me to be very tempting in this day and age, and that is, well, capitalism is going to destroy the environment. So, you know, it's going to hit the fan, and if people listen to me and people like me, then perhaps we can, you know, have a nice ending to that. And if they don't, they're doomed anyway. Well, first of all, it's worth it doomed anyway, so it doesn't do us any goddamn good. And that was true in if capitalism built its own crises, that was also true back in the Marx. Crises are no fun for the innocent. And environmental crises, even less so. So, and I also don't think that, I think it's a terrible mistake to underestimate the resiliency of capitalism. And the difference is it's not that it's technically flawed, it's humanly flawed. It's humanly flawed because it doesn't allow human beings to get what they want out of life. You can't have democracy with a capitalist economy. I mean, democracy over economic life. You can't have fairness in a capitalist economy. And you can't you can't be a steward of the environment as long as you are saddled with a capitalist economy. And what we need to do is to essentially teach that to others. It's not that it's technically flawed. It's that it is just not what human beings want out of their economy, and there is a better way.
My problem with capitalism is that it's a form of economic coercion. Nobody wants to work in a coal mine.
Yes.
Nobody volunteers for it. How do you deal with the fact without coercing somebody to work in a coal mine?
There's lots of I hated changing diapers, and I had five kids. Now, do you think my wife let me get away without changing diapers? No, I married a radical feminist. You know, from the Red Roses Collective up at Boston University. There are lots of tasks that nobody wants to do. Well, how do you get people to do them? Well, first of all, if you know they're being equitably shared, there's a whole difference in attitude about whether or not you're willing to do it. And the second thing is, that's exactly what we're going to compensate people for. What do people deserve compensation for? Doing the unpleasant tasks. So we're setting up a system where it's not only fair that these things are shared, but we recognize that it's those unpleasant things that people are being compensated for. That is the basis of compensation from the economy or from whatever little part of the economy we can make ourselves at a certain point.
Thank you, Hanel.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was Professor Robin Hanel speaking in January 2001 at the National Conference on Organized Resistance in Washington, D.C. Thanks to George King for recording the material used in tonight's program.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.